Lowe's knows that free makes everything better. That's why our rewards members get free standard shipping on the things they need and want, starting at Silver Key status every day. Savings for rewards members add up fast, so why wait? Join for free today. Lowe's, we help, you save. Not available in Alaska and Hawaii. Exclusions and more terms apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/shipping terms. Subject to change.
Epic views, waterfall mists, summit sunsets. It's all better outside. And with All Trails, you can discover the best of nature with over 450,000 trails around the world. Download the free app today and find your next adventure.
I finally committed to getting back in shape. Hit the gym, ate clean, did everything right. But after 2 days, I felt drained. My body just couldn't keep up. That's when I found Stem Regen. It supports the release of my own stem cells to repair, recover, and actually rebuild from the inside out. Now I'm not just working out, I'm bouncing back. I feel stronger, more energized, and more like myself every single day. Stem Regen didn't just change my routine, it changed my recovery. Empower your body to recover from within, whether you are focused on recovery, longevity, or just overall wellness. Stem Regen helps your body feel the best it can. Release the best version of you. Try Stem Regen today at stemregen.co. Use code POD25 for 25% off your first order. Again, that's stemregen.co, code POD25.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, looking for a whole new thing to be into?
Well, check this and check it out. We're the Sloppy Boys.
And we're basically like pretty much the new classic guys.
We were in a comedy group called the Birthday Boys with Bob Odenkirk, and now we're an indie band and we have a podcast about the drinks of the summer, like the Gator Bite or the Grape Gorilla.
And we have guests that are music people like Jeff Rosenstock or Stefan from the band Pup, or comedy people like Tom Sharpling or Mitch from Doughboys.
Yeah, dude.
We talk about TV and movies and music like Turnstile or King Giz, and it's completely kind of cool.
Ooh.
Give it a listen and check it out to see what you think. But don't forget that we're the new classic guys.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Welcome to Reimagining Liberty, a show about the emancipatory and cosmopolitan case for radical social, political, and economic liberalism. I'm Aaron Ross Powell. Equality is central to the liberal project. Thomas Jefferson failed, dramatically and unforgivably, to live up to this ideal, but he stated it correctly when, in a letter, he wrote, "The mass of mankind has not been born with saddles on their backs, nor a favored few booted and spurred, ready to ride them legitimately." Liberalism views us as equals and demands the law treat us as such. The illiberal project, then, is the denial of this equality, and the failure to notice inequalities, or to view the inequalities afflicting some as less worthy of concern than the inequalities afflicting others, is how nominal liberals can slide into illiberal politics without realizing it. My guest today has spent his career reminding liberals of their blind spots and calling for the principles of a liberal society to be applied consistently, leaving no marginalized groups marginalized. Jonathan Blanks is a writer and editor who has spent the bulk of his career focusing on constitutional law, civil liberties, due process, and criminal legal issues. After more than 12 years at the Cato Institute, Blanks has spent the past few years writing about American culture and the effects of police policy. Reimagining Liberty is a listener-supported show. If you'd like to listen to episodes uninterrupted by ads from our sponsors, you can become a supporter. You'll get my newsletter ad-free as well. To learn more, head to www.reimaginingliberty.com. With that, let's turn to my conversation with Jonathan. This is probably a big question to start with, but what does it mean to say that all men are created equal? And then, if I can make it bigger, what does that tell us about how we should approach the liberal political project?
I think, you know, at the beginning, at its most reductive, that what all men were created equal meant when those words were written was that, you know, educated, propertied white men were wanted the same political rights, and they didn't want to be taxed and all the trappings that went along with that. But over the course of American history, it's been expanded to more and more people. So we don't think of it as all men are created equal, but think all people are created equal. And that, you know, that's been expanded to black men, women, LGBTQ, and that's come through lobbying, legislation, constitutional amendment, and even war. And equality has been this sort of constant point of conflict throughout American history and throughout world history. And I think it's too easy in the current discourse to, like, sort of when the tensions between liberty and equality, that when they play out in the American political context, is, you know, it comes down to, oh, special, like the conservatives will market as like special rights, or put out these ad absurdum arguments that, you know, like Harrison Bergeron, where like too much equality is going to end up in the stultification of excellence. And I think while that is its own sort of tyranny, that's not really what we're talking about. And I think certainly there is an argument that putting equality above all other values, as some political stripes do, like, you know, you sort of your hardcore communists and socialists. But that's not what I think. That's certainly not what liberals are arguing for. And when you think about these barriers to equality that really hinder people's pursuit of happiness, if you will, those hindrances to equality are actually hindrances to the liberal project and hindrances to liberty in and of themselves. So ultimately, what equality means, well, what all men are created equal means, is still, I think, up for grabs. And that's part of, like, again, this is sort of the constant core, one of the core conflicts in our politics. And we haven't achieved it yet. And that's okay. But unfortunately, I think in the current administration, we're obviously moving in the wrong direction. And so as liberals, when we're looking forward to, like, what do we want and what are we going to be fighting for, part of it is fighting against the imposition of more inequality, or the reimposition of inequality through various edicts and erosions of protections and liberties.
This is interesting because I think it exposes a tension in the rhetoric of the right, and a tension that's become much clearer in the first, I don't even know how many months, John, it's been of the new Trump administration, that there was, as you said, there's a tension between equality and liberty, and achieving perfect equality means restricting liberty was an argument, and there is a lot of truth to that. But what that meant on the flip side is there was this argument, and this was an argument that's pretty common among libertarians, that essentially the way you achieve equality is maximizing liberty, right? Like, if we get that most of the inequalities that we would point to in society are in fact the result of state impositions on liberty, and if you got rid of those and you had a regime of perfect or maximized liberty, people would achieve something much closer to equality in a meaningful sense. And I also think that there is something to that argument. And it is true that a lot of racial inequalities we see today, you can trace back to state policies that then have downstream, whether that's obviously slavery, but even like redlining. Right. But I think what we've seen is it turned out that to a great extent, that argument that maximizing liberty increases equality was right, that a liberal society raised the wealth and status and access to social goods and access to essentially dignity and respect of traditionally marginalized groups, whether that was racial groups or sexual orientations or women, that, you know, as we've discussed on the show in the past, like, liberalism made women rich because it made everyone rich, and that wealth allowed them to kind of demand a level of equality that they couldn't get when they were dependent upon husbands. But, and this is the tension that I think what you're what you just discussed gets at is it turns out for a lot of people on the right, they didn't really mean it. Like that, basically that argument of stop aiming at equality and instead aim at liberty was a way to just get people to stop aiming at equality and to get people to stop caring about equality. And the moment that liberty actually started creating equality, you have, this is the whole story of Trumpism, this extraordinary reactionary backlash of like, oh, we actually have to start trying to forcibly resegregate. We actually have to start trying to lower the status of women and get them back into the homes. We actually have to start trying to drive LGBT people out of the public square. We have to step in and put those impositions on liberty back in, because it turns out, yes, liberty actually was creating equality.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of ironic that we got too good at this. We got too good at spreading equality, and there's this backlash. But yeah, I mean, that the hypocrisy has always been there. It's one of the things that sort of drove me away from sort of the strident libertarianism that, you know, you and I, you know, grew up in, so to speak. You know, where, you know, I would say, you know, the Civil Rights Act, it was one of the most liberating pieces of legislation, you know, since the, you know, since at least the, like, the, since the 19th Amendment, and before that up to the Civil War amendments, right? You know, the fact that, you know, they passed and like, no, actually, we mean this. And of course, libertarians have always been very critical of the Accommodations Clause, because the Accommodations Clause, if you don't know, is basically saying that private institutions like restaurants and hotels cannot discriminate on the basis of race if traveling, you know, so basically you couldn't travel through the country. If you're Black, you couldn't travel throughout the South and be guaranteed a place to stay, you know? And so the Accommodations Clause is like there, that's too much of an impingement on, you know, on the freedom of association and that sort of thing. And people would argue this to me, you know, and I'm talking high ups in major libertarian institutions. They're like, you know, we're not going to fight it, but, you know, honestly, I would rather trade. I actually had one tell me, he's like, I would rather, if you could trade away the Civil Rights Act for no drug war, I would pull that in a minute. And I'm just absolutely baffled that someone got to the point that he did and still believes that sort of thing. But insofar as like the argument that they would make is, well, you can fight segregation through the markets. It's like you travel with your feet, you travel with your dollars, you take away from restaurants and hotels that discriminate, and that you know, it'll fix itself out. Well, basically, and it's like, and you can also protest, they would say. And then it turns out we had that, and now it's called cancel culture, and it's absolutely derided on the right by the people who are telling me this was going to be the way to get to civil rights, not using the government. And also, there's this illusion that they're like, well, legislation doesn't really erase racism, and there's a certain amount of truth to that. I mean, there's considerable truth to that, but when did we fix this problem exactly? Was it this? It's like, if we're like, well, we finally said that the Constitution means what it says, how did we get there? Right. And it is just sort of that missing, that role that the government played in expanding liberty to so many Americans that it had been denied to for at least a century.
So what do we do about this in the current moment? Because we have now two major political groups. We have essentially the Trumpist coalition and the anti-Trumpist coalition. And the anti-Trumpist coalition is largely Democrats and kind of old school center left to progressives, that side of the old binary in American politics. But it also includes your never Trump Republicans, Bulwark crowd type people, neocons, and so on. But by and large, those are people who, that like old Democratic coalition, are, as you and I both know from having worked in, you know, kind of liberty movement for our careers, are skeptical of a lot of the freedom maximizing policies that I think we could argue are, many of them are the things that led to, you know, the the wealth and freedom that enabled the kind of equality that there is now this reactionary and statist backlash against. And then on the other hand, you have this Trumpist coalition, which is just, I mean, hostile to everything because it's basically like a personality disorder as a political movement. It's not really much more than that, but they despise liberty and equality. And so how do we navigate that? Because we don't want to go back to that critique that we both agreed there's like a fair amount of truth to, that if you aim like there's the kind of crude aim at equality that undermines liberty, which will then undermine equality, because both of us, I mean, you're well aware of when you empower the state doesn't tend to work in the interests of the downtrodden. And that's a huge blind spot for my progressive friends. So what do we do about that? If we care about both liberty and equality, it seems like we're stuck between two coalitions that are, I mean, obviously one of them right now is significantly better than the other. You know, the anti-Trump coalition, I would much rather have them in power than the Trump coalition. But I have plenty of disagreements with most of the people in that coalition. How do we navigate that?
Well, I mean, if we think back to 12 years ago, you know, we're working at Cato, and more often than not, we're fighting losing fights. That's just part of it. That if you're, you know, as you know, the defenders of liberty is eternal vigilance. And it's also taking an L. It's a lot of taking a lot of L's, really. And so the policy arguments, you just pick your battles and you say that, you know, okay, well, this is where we're going to align with this group and fight for this for this thing, and hopefully we can either mitigate the harm that's coming with the new bill, because most new laws seem like L's, but also just trying to think about what it is that we can do in our areas of specialty. But I think stepping back a bit and thinking more about, you know, sort of the broad picture and getting more people onto this anti-Trump side is really about talking about dignity and what it means for, you know, what that means in practice and what that means in policy. So, for example, you know, the way that they're treating migrants and throwing them into, you know, torture chambers in El Salvador, that's against human dignity. That's wrong. And as Trump gets more and more of his stuff over the table and like trying to get stuff implemented, he's going to hurt more and more people. Trump supporters are already, you know, feeling the hit. So it's a matter of like, okay, well, welcome to the party. this is what we've been talking about, but you're not going to slam him for, you know, being stupid or whatever. He's like, I mean, I do like the memes where it's just like, you know, the woman playing the ukulele and, you know, I didn't ever think the leopards would eat my face. It's a great song. But at the end of the day, we have to say, all right, well, this is what we were talking about. We believe in the dignity of the individual. That means, you know, we don't use the government against our enemies. It means that everyone is equal before the law. And, you know, it's hard to like sell people on an entire project, but if you can use hard examples to say, this is the cost of ignoring these protections. These are the costs of, you know, unilateral executive action. And you wouldn't use those words if you're talking to like your uncle at the Thanksgiving table, but like insofar as like explaining, this is what we need to do to get back to where we were. What you believe in freedom, I believe in freedom. This is the path forward.
It seems though that if we want to make that case, like I want to go back to the people who spoke in the language of liberty. But then, you know, I mean, one way to characterize a lot of the work you have done over the years is essentially pointing out that, hey, if you actually care about the set of values you say you care about, you ought to like care about what's happening to these people, the way that these people are being oppressed. And I, something I've written about a fair amount is, you know, the way that it's one thing to say you have a set of values, and it's one thing to be consistent when you apply them, but also in having a set of values and actually embodying them, it is noticing when those values obtain, Like when situations call into question or call for the application of those values, and that the way that a lot of people in the libertarian movement, but this is the case in any kind of political ideology, one of the ways they can go wrong is not necessarily in like violating their values, in saying like, okay, I value liberty, but in this case, I want to bring the hammer down on these people, which would just be like an inconsistent, you know, you have tread upon your own values, but instead in just not noticing, in saying like, I care a lot about liberty, but I only really notice impositions on liberty when they're happening to these people. But when they're happening to those people over there, it just like doesn't even end up on my radar. Sorry, go ahead.
No. I think so much of that comes down to, and it touches on an issue that you and Janet Buffton talked about last year. I revisited that podcast before coming on. And it's just like, if you take like the fusion route where libertarians and conservatives were massing against, you know, the left and communism, you have this sort of like social milieu where you're just like, okay, this is coming from the right. Right. And from that point, it's a very, you know, for whatever reason, it's a very white, very male space. And when you don't see the context in which all of these things operate, then of course you think it's fine. Let's take, for example, colorblindness as a policy. It's something that libertarians are really big on. And I think there's another tension here where I kind of put them in crudely in like two different categories. It's sort of like a useful idiots category and a I know what I'm doing category, sort of like a Lee Atwater. So the useful idiots are like people who strongly believe that they're doing the right thing because they believe that colorism in law only leads to bad, you know, bad outcomes. And again, there's a good reason to believe that. And I'm on board with the basic core of that. But they don't understand the context in which they're operating. And then there are the people like Lee Atwater, who was the campaign director for H.W. Bush and a longtime Republican operative, who talked about how Republican, propaganda campaigning would, what they, you know, the euphemisms they would use to get to the core audience, because when you had the shift, the Southern shift from the Democrats to the Republicans, they had to be ways to reach that audience without coming out and using dog whistles to get the racists to listen to you, but not actually sound racist. And so he's like, you say busing, you know, which is desegregation, right? That was a political issue in the 70s and 80s when we were growing up, which was, of course, 30 years after Brown v. Board. And you say welfare and all these things that in and of themselves, well, particularly with like welfare and all that, there are, again, libertarian arguments for why they should be curtailed or eliminated so that the market can make people richer. That's fine. There are traps that welfare creates, and that's absolutely legitimate. But not understanding the context that most American cities have poor black neighborhoods, and those exist because of both private and public policies over years, whether it's redlining, as you mentioned, or the Eisenhower Highway Project that destroyed, you know, black neighborhoods that had, that had, you know, thriving business districts. Or you have terrorism and like house bombings when people in Chicago, where, you know, they were trying to desegregate neighborhoods and they blew up their house when black people moved in. You know, these are the histories of why these things have happened. And so you're just like, oh, can we be race conscious? Can we fix the problems of the past? In, you know, for every right, there is a duty, and for every rights violation, there should be a remedy. These are old rights violations. They have. You know, real world effects today. And the idea that like someone growing up in a poor black neighborhood has the same opportunity that a kid who's growing up in the Upper West Side of Manhattan going to a private school because his parents are rich and he's white, like, it's just not real. And it's like understanding there has to be some sort of, you know, like, now how to fix that, it's a long, complicated story, and I don't have a simple answer. I wish I did. But like, insofar as like understanding that these policies came from somewhere, and the people who are still fighting for liberty and still fighting for equality, which in many ways are the same thing, in sort of the most extreme cases, finding a way to fix those problems is, I think, outside of once we get past Trumpism, is, again, we need to get back to that, because that is where so much of the disconnect happens between the sort of traditional right and the traditional left, because the right is saying, well, no, we don't want special rights. And I'm like, dude, it's not about special rights. It's about giving help to the people who need it.
We all belong outside. We're drawn to nature, whether it's the recorded sounds of the ocean we doze off to or the succulents that adorn our homes. Nature makes all of our lives, well, better. Despite all this, we often go about our busy lives removed from it. But the outdoors is closer than we realize. With AllTrails, you can discover trails nearby and explore confidently with offline maps and on-trail navigation. Download the free app today.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
I do think that coalition, you mentioned the fusionism, is a big problem for this. And one story of the last decade or so is the fusionism has become more obviously untenable. That I don't think it was ever, I mean, I think fusionism was always a mistake. I think it was a mistake because the conservatism and the right and libertarianism are philosophically incompatible. The right is a project of maintaining hierarchies, and liberty is ultimately dissolves hierarchies. That's like one of the things that it does. And so there's a fundamental incompatibility between these two views of the world and the ultimate aims, even if you can agree on a handful of policies for some period of time. And I also think it was strategically, tactically a mistake, because I don't think it led to libertarian victories. I think the big victories for liberty that we can point to in the last 50 years are not things that the right championed. It's, you know, like, we're on our way to ending the war on drugs. It's a huge, that wasn't the right, gay marriage. Like, we can list these. They were not things that came from the right. Lower taxes, but even there, it's been like inconsistent. And so I think it was a mistake, but the last 10 years have made it obvious it's just entirely untenable, in part because the right-wing coalition just pivoted to basically blaming libertarians for everything that was wrong with the world. Like, they tell this story that essentially America went wrong because libertarians somehow took over all the institutions. And it's not, as we both know, having worked in these circles, we never felt like we were in control of any institutions. But I think one of the things this has exposed, and it's been interesting watching people kind of respond to it, is especially with the second Trump administration, for a lot of people on kind of the Trumpist right, masks really came off. And for a lot of like what I'll call like reactionary centrists, masks really came off. And it became very clear that it wasn't that, like, actually maybe that being really into race and IQ was a sign that like these people were just like legitimately racist, or the some of this, like, the misogyny became very clear and much more out in the open, or the desire to be just America as a white nationalist country. Like, they're like, nope, this is what we were all along. And I think there's been this real tension watching people, like, one of the things I try to get across, like, I don't think a lot of people understand about DC is how small of a community, like, kind of elite DC circles are. And everybody knows everybody, and everybody's hanging out with everybody. And you're doing it in this kind of decontextualized, like, everyone is just in the same business, is the sense, right? Like, we're all in this business of policy, and you, John, might be aiming at like working for a different set of policies than I am, but we're in the business of policy in the same way that, like, if we both show up at like the same trade show and our companies are making similar products, we still go out and grab beers together, and we're not like at each other's throats, even though we're competitors. Like, that's the kind of sense. It's just, it's business. And we're all in a small community in the same business. But in fact, policy is about directing the state to apply force to people's decisions, right? Like, it's a very heavy thing. And when you're aiming at something fundamentally different, it's about a difference of values. It's about a difference of like who you think the state should put a boot on and who don't think it should be put a boot on. And that's really, I think, torn at that conceit that we're all just kind of like in the same business, because now you have like, no, the MAGA Trumpist right is really aimed at a fundamentally different world than like you or I want. And it is a world that both of us, I think, agree is like, is basically down to its core immoral. It's not something, there's no value in the world that they want. And I think the masks coming off, it's like, one of the things we have to get past is like, oh, these people that I used to have drinks with, you know, we see this, each other, actually like aren't good people. I shouldn't be friendly and palling around with them and expressing being racist, being misogynistic, wanting to drive LGBT people out of public life. Like, these are not questions of policy differences. These are questions of value differences. And I think that got papered over for a long time, but it really can't be papered over anymore. And to me, that's the big thing that has to be like getting back to really pushing liberty, which I think is the most valuable political project, requires getting back to saying, no, this is like, we start with values. This is about values from day one. And we need a coalition around values. And the problem with fusionism was it was like, my allies are the people who I can draw a list of some policies and say, we agree on these policies. But the Trump years have shown, like, when the policies preferences are motivated by incompatible values, eventually you diverge on the policies too.
Yeah, it would be nice if, you know, every time someone could just, like a liberal could just say, racism is bad, full stop. Unfortunately, that's not my experience. You know, it was, racism is bad, but, you know, it's worse if we get the state involved. And, you know, again, for a good number of that, that's correct. For a good, for many policies, that's absolutely correct. But there was this reticence to condemn racism. And I, part of it, I think, was probably donor driven. But I think part of it was also just, again, that cultural milieu where they come from the same place and they're, you know, the uncomfortable truths is like, yeah, John, race is a social construct. We shouldn't put the state behind it. But also, race explains, you know, disparity, like economic, educational, intellectual disparities, IQ, and that sort of thing. It seems that, you know, and I have, you know, my qualms with how ACLU National runs its operation. But insofar as, like, you can understand it historically, where, like, that's where the libertarians and the liberals got together pretty well. It's like, we're defending, you know, we're defending constitutional rights, except guns, which, whatever. But insofar as, like, they can put lawyers out defending Nazis who are marching through Skokie, Illinois, but they're not inviting them to dinner. On the libertarian side, you see Amy Wax at Cato, you see, you know, Charles Murray at various events. And it's not just Cato, I'm just talking about the right milieu. I mean, Charles Murray wrote a book that, you know, tried to justify racial hierarchy, didn't consider the context, of course, and he's got no expertise in genetics, whatever. And as a child, he burned a cross, and he said, "Oh, I didn't really mean anything about it. It was really stupid." Like, you have a cross burning your genesis, you keep inviting to do things, and it's just like, no, actually, liberals should say racism is wrong. And I don't say you have to call Charles Murray a racist, but insofar as like, you have to understand that, like, there should be some line drawing in who you are. Now, like in a voting coalition, that's one thing. And if you're talking about a political party, but actually having a taking a stand and saying racism is wrong, regardless, not necessarily calling people racist, but like saying racism is wrong, is something that liberals in the right centered space haven't been very. It's not that they won't do it, but they almost always qualify it. And it's been frustrating for years trying to fight against that because, again, working in libertarian space, part of the project I was working on for a while was trying to make it a place better for Black Americans and other people of color and other minorities generally. And it seems it's so weird that a group of people who define themselves by liberty have so few voices of a group of people for whom liberty and the American project has always been a massive tension, like from slavery to Jim Crow to now. And that disconnect is real, and there is reticence to fight. It's like, you know, to ameliorate it, where, you know, they're like, why I don't want to get involved in identity politics. All politics is identity politics. If you talk about farm policy, you're talking about farmers. You're talking about, you know, rural America, like, and their access to broadband. That's an identity. All these things, again, and so long as you actually have, you know, Black neighborhoods who get policed differently, who have different access to food and all these other things, race still matters, even though it is a social construct. They're right. But like, that rejection of understanding that there's a problem in the first place, this sort of detextualized freedom that is so prevalent in right, you know, in right tilting liberalism. I mean, I'm just sick of it, frankly. And it's, it's a values-based liberalism is absolutely the way forward. Because again, it's like talking about human dignity, talking about individualism. And it doesn't mean that everyone has to like agree on every single policy choice. It's like, oh, well, they're oppressed. Therefore, when they say that they want this, you know, they want this solution, we must give it to them. No, you still get to like weigh you weigh the equities and you say, well, you know, is this actually going to improve people? Does this actually create more problems than it solves? Absolutely on a case-by-case basis. But insofar as like actually standing up and saying, no, the racists don't believe what we believe fundamentally. And that's, I think, a massive problem with Trump, whereas like here you have clearly, you know, how many people still defend? It's like, well, you can't really say that's racist. I mean, come on, y'all. It's like you're revoking, you know, legal status for all the people, so many people from, you know, Hispanic and Arab countries, but like, oh, we can bring in the Afrikaners. Like it's just ridiculous. And it's so frustrating that, you know, so many people of libertarian and liberal ilk have, you know, picked and chosen what values, when to apply their personal values and when not to. And when it comes down to race, it almost always falls down on the traditional status quo.
It does feel like though there's an opportunity here in the current moment. So let's bracket the discussion of whether American democracy and liberal institutions survive the current moment. And let's just say that, you know, Trump fails in his clear quest to consolidate an authoritarian regime. And I'm still pretty hopeful he's going to fail at that, although he's going to destroy a whole hell of a lot of stuff along the way and make America a poorer and worse place. But let's assume that Trumpism and the MAGA movement get pretty thoroughly kicked to the curb in 2028, and that Trumpism kind of, to some extent, dies with Trump, which I think is also fairly likely, given that it seems to be primarily a personality cult and none of his kind of idiot sons seem capable of inheriting that mantle. And we're in this period of rebuilding because we just can't after this. We can't go back to like where we were. Like institutions will have to be rebuilt. American culture and society will have to be rebuilt to a great extent. I think one thing that this moment, this masks off moment has shown people is how genuinely ugly all of this stuff really is when it is.
We all belong outside. We're drawn to nature, whether it's the recorded sounds of the ocean we doze off to or the succulents that adorn our homes. Nature makes all of our lives, well, better. Despite all this, we often go about our busy lives removed from it. But the outdoors is closer than we realize. With AllTrails, you can discover trails nearby and explore confidently. With offline maps and on-trail navigation, download the free app today.
Unchained, when it doesn't have guardrails, when it has the power to do what it wants. And I think this is why we're seeing the far right support collapsing in other countries around the world, is they're looking at the US and being like, oh, this is actually really bad when these kinds of, when these guys get power. And it's shattering too, some of the, like, both know, you know, like in a lot of DC circles and kind of centrist circles, there is this like, oh, you know, those, I may not agree with everything these like right wing, these alt-right guys or whatever, but they're like edgy. Like, it's kind of cool and exciting and titillating that what they're saying, because it bucks the status quo and is contrarian and all that. But, you know, and we're seeing this with some of like even like Richard Anania was talking about this, like, but you're seeing this kind of like, oh, these people I palled around with actually, when they said they were Nazis, they actually were, like, they were, they meant it. And Nazism turns out to be like actually kind of bad. It's not cool and edgy, you know, like there's this realization, which is, it's frustrating how long it took for these people to realize that, but, you know, we're, and so it does feel like the far right, is getting its moment, but it's not going to win the conversation for like the future, because people are seeing the ugliness. They're seeing how destructive it is. They're seeing it's not good for the economy. It's not good for business. You know, the Wall Street Journal editorial page is turned against Trump.
Who could have done this?
It's just awful and wretched. And so that feels like for the kind of values liberalism, that opens up a real opportunity. And it feels like those of us who lead with the values, you know, this is my experience talking with people who are, I was always told, like, progressives and lefties won't listen to a libertarian. You know, like, there's no point in even kind of, but I've had a lot of success talking with progressives and lefties. But you start with, like, the values, and you get them like, oh, this is a person who, they get them thinking like, this is a person who has good values. And if they have good values, then I'll listen to them. And I think that's true for all of us. Like, you start with like, is this a good person or not? Is this person motivated by good views or wrong views? And then I may disagree with their policies, but like, I'll listen to them about those policies, because it's like, it's like in, they're in good faith as opposed to in bad faith. And I think the real kind of shocking ugliness of the current moment has, I guess, a lot of people more receptive to the values conversation, because it's become so clear that this is, politics really is about values in this moment. The policy conversations are still really important, but they're not as central. Like, it's not, Stephen Miller is not doing what he's doing to immigrants because he actually thinks that like immigrants are something of a drag on the economy. He's doing what he's doing because he wants a white society, and he hates people who are different. And those are values questions. Those aren't policy questions. So I guess that's my, yeah, that's my like hopeful, is maybe we can kind of be part of these conversations in a way that it was harder before, in kind of a fusionist days, or before it was so obvious what the far right really represents.
Yeah, I think it is a great opportunity, and I've had good experience with this. So I, in the early days before criminal justice became like sort of the issue in DC for a while, I started going into these spaces. And they were like, where are you? I was like, oh, welcome. Where are you from? And I say, the Cato Institute. They're like, oh, And so I was definitely treated with a bit of a cold shoulder because I was right-coded and going into these pretty left-heavy spaces. And then I started talking and we started, you know, and we had a lot in common and we had like, we feared the same things. We were against the same things. And I became as accepted as anyone else who, you know, they're just like, and, you know, sometimes it's pretty condescending. They're like, oh yeah, he's one of the good ones. Which, you know, depending on the space has more interesting and funny meanings, but insofar as, yeah, just meet people where they are and show that you have the same values and it can work. And I think that, sort of piggybacking on that and what I said earlier, it's like the more that Trump gets to do, the fewer people that will support him outside of his sort of, you know, white nationalist grievance clan, which is large and it's influential. But insofar as like, you know, again, if you're into low taxes, maybe. But even then, they're like, even Trump is like, maybe we need to tax some people because, you know, all these things that I want to pay for, they're really expensive. Small government folks, come on. No, it's not working. Like trimming around the edges at Doge, like it was just absolutely ridiculous where it's like, oh, okay, we're going to cut this few million here, a few million there when like it's not even going to cut it's not even touching the interest on the national debt and all that, you know. So they're not happy. Free traders, obviously not happy. Civil libertarians, obviously not happy. And you go down the list of like traditional, like Republican, you know, policy people. And there's who's left, like who's still getting what they want. And so, yes, there are groups of people who, because it is a personality cult, because it's like they make them feel good and they don't really think about, you know, they don't think about policies. They can call them low information voters, whatever. Like, there's always going to be that core that you have to fight with. But insofar as once Trump is gone, that what's left, and there's going to be a whole lot, like no one's going to rally to the banner of Stephen Miller or Steve Bannon. It's not happening, which is great. But obviously it's trying to figure out how to fix this going forward. I was talking to a few weeks ago, I was talking to a Republican staffer that I've known my entire time in DC. And he works on the Hill. And, you know, he's like in a candid moment, he was just basically saying, you know, so much of the problem is, because I mean, so many people on the Hill don't like Donald Trump. They don't like any of this stuff going on, but they feel that they have to through either literally violence, intimidation that came from January 6th and pardoning all those people and you know, his supporters acting out, but also just the political consequences because they're in deep red districts where they're winning by 34 points. You know, you cannot. And so they need sort of the crazy Trumper class to get out of the primary so they can win. And so because they are self-interested and it's like figuring out new ways, I think, not to get too in the weeds on this because there's so many different things we can talk about, but just like it's something I hadn't really thought about before that moment. But basically how the rigging of districts so that they're completely safe from any sort of partisan, you know, challenge allows the radicals to solidify their power instead of, you know, because Trumpists have never been a majority, even if because I don't think most people who voted for Trump voted, you know, for all the stuff that they're getting, you know, I mean, they did and they didn't, but really finding new ways to rearrange the political system in ways that actually allow for competitive fighting. So actually be more representative of people that and what they want. I don't believe democracy is going to fix everything. I remember talking to a lefty activist many years ago and she's like, we just need more democracy. We just need more democracy. I'm like, that's not, have you met? It's like, they just said tension. It was like, well, if you say we're in a white supremacist society and what we need is more democracy, I don't think you know what you're asking for. but insofar as I do think people with different values need more say in the system. And right now it's sort of skewing in the wrong direction.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode of Reimagining Liberty. If you'd like to listen to future episodes free of ads and sponsorships, you can become a supporter for just a few dollars a month. Head to www.aaronrosspowell.com to learn more.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey guys, welcome to Giggly Squad, a place where we make fun of everything, but most importantly, ourselves.
I'm Paige DeSorbo.
I'm Hannah Berner.
Welcome to the squad.
Giggly Squad started on Summer House when we were giggling during an inappropriate time.
But of course, we can't be managed.
So we decided to start this podcast to continue giggling.
We will make fun of pop culture news.
We're watching.
Fashion trends. Pep talks where we give advice.
Mental health moments.
And games and guests.
Listen to Giggly Squad on Acast or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Lowe's knows you've got a job to do, and we help get it done. With the My Lowe's Pro Rewards program, eligible members save more. With volume discounts on qualifying orders through a quote of $2,000 or more. Join for free today. Lowe's, we help you save. Offer can't be combined with any other discount, contract, and or special pricing. Exclusions, more terms, and restrictions apply. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.